Mac to hurt him, she hopes. But he only laughs again, loudly abandoned to the warmth and buoyancy and sounds encompassing anonymous fucking, drowsiness, ease, finds himself with a thick red hard-on and slipped it without ado into the solemn girl half-hidden inside her cloud of damp black Spanish lace, eyes any place but on his, a swing now through the interior fog, dreaming of home. Well, that's all reet. He isn't fucking her eyes, is he? He'd rather not have to look at her face anyhow. All he wants is the brown skin, the shut mouth, that sweet and nigger submissiveness. She'll do anything he orders. Yeah, he can hold her head under the water till she drowns. He can bend her hand back. Yeah, break her fingers like that cunt in Frankfurt the other week. Pistol whip. Bite till blood comes. Visions go swarming, violent, less erotic than you think, more occupied with thrust, impact, penetration, and such other military values. Which is not to say he isn't enjoying himself innocently as you do, or that Manuela doesn't find herself too in some casual athletic way liking the ride up and down the stubborn red shaft of Major Marvey, though her mind is on a thousand other things now, a frock of Sandra's that she covets, words to various songs, an itch below her left shoulder blade, a tall English soldier she saw as she came through the bar around supper time, his brown forearm, shirt rolled to the elbow against the zinc top of the table. Voices in the steam. Alarms. Many feet clopping in shower shoes. Silhouettes moving by. A gaudy evacuation. What in the hell? Major Marvey about to come, riding on his elbows, distracted, squinting in several directions, rapidly getting a soft off. Raid! A voice going past. MPs! Shivers somebody else. Gah! Screams Major Marvey, who has just recalled the presence of 2.5 ounces of cocaine in his uniform pockets. He rolls, walrus heavy, Manuela sliding away and off his limpening, nervous penis, hardly aroused but enough of a professional to feel the price includes a token puto and sin vergüenza now. Scrambling up out of the water, skidding on the tiles, Duane Marvey, bringing up the rear, emerges into an ice-cold changing room to find the last of the bathers fled, the closets stone empty except for one multicolored velvet something or other. Hey, where's my uniform? Stomping on the floor, fists at his sides, face very red. Oh, you motherless bastards! Thereupon throwing several bottles and ashtrays, breaking two windows, attacking the wall with an ornate umbrella stand, feeling better for it in his mind. He hears combat boots in rooms nearby, girls screaming, a phonograph grid knocked screeching into silence. He checks out this plush or velvet rig, finds it to be a pig costume complete with mask, considers slyly that no MP would bother an innocent fun-seeking pig. As humorless, limey voices move closer through the rooms of pussies, he rips frantically at silk lining and straw padding to make room for his own fat. And, struggled at last inside, phew, zipped up, mask hiding face, safe, clownish anonymous, pushes out through bead curtains, then upstairs to the bar, only to run spang into a full division of the red-hatted suckers coming his way, all in step, swear to God. "Here's our elusive swine, gentlemen," pocked face, blunt and ragged mustache, pointing a pistol right at his head, others moving up quickly. A civilian comes pushing through, spade shape blazing dark on his smooth cheek. "Right, Dr. Muffridge is outside with the ambulance, and we'd like two of your chaps for a moment, Sergeant, till we're all secure."
"Certainly, sir."
Wrists weak from steam and comfort gathered skillfully behind his back before he can even get mad enough to start yelling at them. Cold steel, ratcheting like a phone number being dialed late at night with no hope in hell of any answer ever. God damn! He finally gets out, mask muffling his voice, giving it an echo that hurts his ears. What in the hell's wrong with you, boy? Don't you know who I am? But, uh-oh, wait a minute. If they've found the uniform, Marvey ID, and cocaine in the same set of pockets, maybe it isn't such a hot idea to tell them his name just yet.
Lieutenant Slothrop, we presume. Come along now.
Slothrop, okay. We'll just wait. See what the score is. Square the dope thing later. Dumb. Say it must have been planted. Maybe even find him a Jewish lawyer good enough to nail the suckers for false arrest. He's escorted out the door and into the idling ambulance. The bearded driver gives him only a quick, over-the-shoulder glance, then lets in the clutch. Before he can think to struggle, the other civilian and the MPs have quickly strapped Marvey at knees and chest to a stretcher. A pause by an army lorry to let the MPs off again. Then they continue on, toward Cuxhaven. Marvey thinks. Nothing but night. Moon-softened blindness out the window. Can't tell.
Sedation now?
Ace of Spades crouches beside him, shining a pocket flashlight over ampules in his kit, rattling syringes and points.
Yes, we're almost there. I don't see why they couldn't have given us hospital space for this. The driver laughs. Oh, yes, I can just see that. Filling the hypodermic slowly. Well, we are under orders. I mean, there's nothing... Dear chap, it's not the most respectable operation.
Hey, Major Marvey tries to raise his head. Operation? What's this, boy?
Shh, ripping away part of one pig suit sleeve, bearing Marvey's arm.
I don't want no needle.
But it's already in the vein, and discharging as the other man seeks to calm him.
I mean, you really got the wrong fella, you know?
Of course, Lieutenant. End of side 19. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 20. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 709.
Hey, no, not me. I'm a major.
He should be more emphatic about this, more convincing. Maybe it's the sucking pig mask in the way. Only he can hear his voice, now given back entirely to himself, flatter, metallic. They can't hear him.
Major Duane Marvey.
They don't believe him. Don't believe his name. Not even his name. Panic strikes him deeper than the sedative has reached, and he begins to buck truly in terror against the straps, feeling small muscles along his chest stretch into useless twinges of pain. Oh, God. Beginning to scream now with all his might. No words, only cries, as loud as the strap across his chest will let him.
For pity's sake, the driver sighs, can't you shut him up, Spontoon?
Spontoon has already ripped the pig mask away and replaces it now with one of gauze, which he holds on with one hand while dripping ether with the other whenever the thrashing head comes within range.
Pointsman has taken leave of his senses,
he feels obliged to say, irritated out of all patience. If he calls this a calm imperturbable. All right, we're on the strand now, no one in sight. Muffage drives down toward the water. The sand just solid enough to hold the ambulance, everything very white in the small moon, which is at its zenith, perfect ice.
Oh, Marvey moans. Oh, fuck. Oh, no. Oh, Jesus.
The words in long, drugged diminuendo struggles against his bonds, weakening as Muffage parks them at last, an olive-drab derelict tiny on this broad beach, the enormous slick stretching away moonward to the threshold of the north wind.
Plenty of time, Muffage looking at his watch. We're catching the C-47 at one. They said they could hold up for a bit.
Sighs of comfort before turning to their task.
That man's connections,
Spontoon shaking his head, removing the instruments from their disinfectant solution and laying them on a sterile cloth beside the stretcher.
My, let's hope he never turns to a life of crime, eh?
Fuck, groans Major Marvey softly. Oh, fuck me, will you?
Both men have scrubbed and donned masks and rubber gloves. Muffage has switched on a dome light which stares down a soft, radiant eye. The two work quickly, in silence, two wartime pros used to field expediency, with only an occasional word from the patient, a whisper, a white, pathetic grope in his ether darkness after the receding point of light that's all he has left of himself. It's a simple procedure. The crotch of the velvet costume is torn away. Muffage decides to dispense with shaving the scrotum. He douses it first with iodine, then squeezes in turn each testicle against the red-veined and hairy bag, makes the incision quickly and cleanly through skin and surrounding membranes, popping the testicle itself out through the wound and welling blood, pulling it out with the left hand till the cords, hard and soft, are strung visible under the light. As if they are musical strings, he might, a trifle moon-mad, strum here on the empty beach into appropriate music. His hand hesitates, but then, reluctantly bowing to duty, he severs them at the proper distances from the slippery stone, each incision then being bathed in disinfectant, and the two neat slits side by side finally sutured up again. The testicles are plopped into a bottle of alcohol.
Souvenirs for pointsmen,
Muffage sighs, stripping off the surgical gloves. Give that one another shot. It might be better if he sleeps through and someone back in London explains this to him. Muffage starts up the motor, backs in a half circle, and slowly heads back up toward the road, the vast sea lying still behind. Back at Pussy's, Slothrop curls in a wide, crisp-sheeted bed beside Solange, asleep and dreaming about Zwölfkinder, and Bianca smiling, he and she riding on the wheel, their compartment become a room, one he's never seen, a room in a great complex of apartments big as a city, whose corridors can be driven or bicycled along like streets. Trees lining them, and birds singing in the trees. And Solange, oddly enough, is dreaming of Bianca too, though under a different aspect.
It's of her own child, Ilse, riding lost through the zone on a long freight train that never seems to come to rest. She isn't unhappy, nor is she searching exactly for her father, but Lainey's early dream for her is coming true. She will not be used. There is change and departure, but there is also help when least looked for from the strangers of the day, and hiding out among the accidents of this drifting humility, never quite to be extinguished, a few small chances for mercy. Upstairs, one Milner, valise full of his night's treasures, an American major's uniform and papers, and 2.5 ounces of cocaine, explains to the shaggy American sailor that Herr von Göhl is a very busy man, attending to business in the north, as far as he knows, and has not commissioned him to bring to Cuxhaven any kind of papers, no military discharges, passports, nothing. He's sorry. Perhaps the sailor's friend is mistaken. Perhaps, again, it's only a temporary delay. One appreciates that forgeries take time. Bodine watches him leave, unaware of what's inside that valise. Albert Krypton has drunken himself unconscious. Shirley comes wandering in, bright-eyed and restless, wearing a black garter belt and stockings. "Hmm," she says with a certain look. "Hmm," says Seaman Bodine. "And anyway, it was only 10 cents at the Battle of the Bulge." So he has traced Weissmann's battery from Holland, across the salt marshes and lupin and bones of cows, to find this. Lucky he's not superstitious. He'd be taking it for a prophetic vision. There is, of course, a perfectly rational explanation, but Cicerone has never read Martin Fierro. He watches from his temporary command post in a copse of jumpers on a low hill. Through the binoculars he sees two men, one white, one black, holding guitars. Townspeople are gathered in a circle, but these Cicerone can crop out, leaving in his elliptical field a scene with the same structure as the male-female singing contest in the middle of a flat grassland in Central Asia well over a decade ago. A coming together of opposites that signaled then his own approach to the Kyrgyz light. What does it signal this time? Over his head the sky is streaked and hard as marble. He knows. Weissmann installed the Escherette and fired the 00000 somewhere close by. Enzian can't be far behind. It will be here. But he has to wait. Once that would have been unbearable, but since Major Marvey dropped out of sight, Cicerone has been a little more cautious. Marvey was a key man. There is a counterforce in the zone. Who was the Soviet intelligence man who showed up just before the fiasco in the clearing? Who tipped the Schwarzkommando off to the raid? Who got rid of Marvey? He's been trying hard not to believe too much in the rocket cartel. Since his illumination that night, Marvey drunk, bloody chiclets declaiming on the virtues of Herbert Hoover, Cicerone has been watching for evidence. Gerhard von Göhl, with his corporate octopus wrapping every last negotiable item in the zone, must be in it, consciously or otherwise. Cicerone last week was on the point of flying back to Moscow. He'd seen Mravyenko, one of the Viam people, briefly in Berlin. They met in the Tiergarten, two officers ostensibly strolling in the sun. Work crews shoveled cold patch into holes in the pavement, banging it flat with shovels. Bicycle riders ratcheted by, skeleton functional as their machines. Small clusters of civilians and military were back under the trees, sitting on fallen trunks or lorry wheels, stirring through bags and valises, dealing. "You're in trouble," Mravyenko said. He'd been a remittance man, too, back in the 30s, and the most maniacal, systemless chess player in Central Asia. His tastes ran low enough to include even blindfold chess, which Russian sensibilities find unutterably gross. Cicerone sat down at the board each time more upset than the last, trying to be amiable, to jolly the madman into some kind of rational play. Most often he'd lose. But it was either Mravyenko or the Semyuryetche winter. "Do you have any idea what's going on?" Mravyenko laughed. "Does anybody? Molotov isn't telling Vyshinsky. But they know things about you. Remember the Kyrgyz light? Sure you do. Well, they found out about that. I didn't tell them, but they got to somebody." "It's ancient history. Why bring it up now?" "You're regarded as useful," Mravyenko said. They looked at each other then for a long time. It was a death sentence. Usefulness out here ends as quickly as a communique. Mravyenko was afraid, and not entirely for Cicerone either. "What will you do, Mravyenko?" "Try not to be very useful. They're not perfect, though. Both men knew this was meant to be comfort and isn't working too well. They don't really know what makes you useful. They go on statistics. I don't think you were supposed to survive the war. When you did, they had to look at you more closely. Maybe I'll survive this, too. And that was when he got the idea of flying to Moscow. But just about then, word came in that Weissmann's battery couldn't be traced any further than the heath, and the renewed hope of meeting Enzian stopped him from going, the seductive hope that's leading him further each day from any chance of continuing on past the other side of that meeting. He never supposed he would. The real question is, will they get him before he gets Enzian? All he needs is a little more time. His only hope is if they're looking for Enzian too, or the Escaret, and using him the same way he thinks he's using Sothrop. The horizon is still clear, has been all day. Cypress-shaped junipers stand in the rust and hazy distances, still as monuments. The first purple flowers are showing on the heather. It is not the busy peace of late summer, but the peace of a burial ground. Among the prehistoric German tribes, that's what this country was, the territory of the dead. A dozen nationalities, dressed as Argentine estancieros, crowd around the soup kitchen commissary. El Ñato is standing on the saddle of his horse, gaucho style, looking off into the German pampas. Felipe is kneeling out in the sun, making his noontime devotionals to the living presence of a certain rock back in the wasteland of La Rioja, on the eastern slopes of the Andes. According to an Argentine legend from the last century, Maria Antonia Correa followed her lover into that arid land, carrying their newborn child. Herders found her a week later dead. But the infant had survived by nursing from her corpse. Rocks near the site of the miracle have since been the objects of yearly pilgrimages, but Felipe's particular rock embodies also an intellectual system. For he believes, as do M.F. Beale and others, in a form of mineral consciousness, not too much different from that of plants and animals except for the time scale. Rock's time scale is a lot more stretched out. We're talking frames per century. Felipe, like everybody else here lately, has been using a bit of movie language. Per millennium. Colossal. But Felipe has come to see, as those who are not sentient rocksters seldom do, that history, as it's been laid on the world, is only a fraction, an outward and visible fraction. That we must also look to the untold, to the silence around us, to the passage of the next rock we notice, to its eons of history under the long and female persistence of water and air. Who'll be there once or twice per century to trip the shutter? Down to the lowland where your paths, human and mineral, are most likely to cross. Graciela Imago Portales, dark hair parted in the middle and drawn back from her forehead, wearing a long black riding skirt and black boots, sits shuffling cards, stacking herself flushes, full houses, four of a kind, just for her own amusement. The supernumeraries have brought next to nothing to play with. She knew it would come to this. She'd thought once that by using it only in games, money would lose its reality. Wither away. Has it, or is she playing a game with herself? It seems Belaustegui has been watching her more closely since they got here. She doesn't want to threaten his project. She's been to bed with the solemn engineer a few times, though at first, back in BA, she'd have sworn to you she couldn't have drunk him even with a silver straw. And she knows he's a gambler, too. A good pair, wired front to front. She picked it up the first time he touched her. The man knows his odds. The shapes of risk are intimate to him as loved bodies. Each moment has its value, its probable success against other moments in other hands, and the shuffle for him is always moment to moment. He can't afford to remember other permutations, might-have-beens, only what's present, dealt him by something he calls chance, and Graciela calls God. He will stake everything on this anarchist experiment, and if he loses, he'll go on to something else. But he won't hold back. She's glad of that. He's a source of strength. She doesn't know, if the moment came, how strong she'd be. Often at night, she'll break through a fine membrane of alcohol and optimism to see really how much she needs the others, how little use, unsupported, she could ever be. The sets for the movie to be help some. The buildings are real, not a false front in sight. The boliche is stocked with real liquor, the pulperia with real food. The sheep, cattle, horses, and corrals are real. The huts are weatherproof and are being slept in. When Von Gerl leaves, if he ever comes, nothing will be struck. Any of the extras who want to stay are welcome. Many of them only want to rest up a while for more DP trains, more fantasies of what home was like before the destruction, and some dream of getting somewhere. They'll move on, but will others come? And what will the military government think of a community like this in the middle of their garrison state? It isn't the strangest village in the zone. Skolidotsi has come in out of his wanderings with tales of Palestinian units, strayed all the way from Italy, who've settled down farther east and started up Hasidic communes on the pattern of a century and a half ago. There are one-time company towns come under the fleet and jittery rule of Mercury, dedicated now to a single industry, mail delivery, eastward and back, in among the Soviets and out, 100 marks a letter. One village in Mecklenburg has been taken over by army dogs, Dobermans and shepherds, each one conditioned to kill on sight any human except the one who trained him. But the trainers are dead men now, or lost. The dogs have gone out in packs, ganged cows in the fields and brought the carcasses miles overland back to the others. They've broken into supply depots, Rin Tin Tin style, and looted K-rations, frozen hamburger, cartons of candy bars. Bodies of neighboring villagers and eager sociologists litter all the approaches to the Hundstadt. Nobody can get near it. One expeditionary force came armed with rifles and grenades, but the dogs all scattered in the night, slender as wolves, and no one could bring himself to destroy the houses and shops. No one wanted to occupy the village either. So they went away, and the dogs came back. If there are lines of power among themselves, loves, loyalties, jealousies, no one knows. Someday G5 might send in troops, but the dogs may not know of this, may have no German anxieties about encirclement, may be living entirely in the light of the one man-installed reflex, kill the stranger. There may be no way of distinguishing it from the other given quantities of their lives, from hunger or thirst or sex. For all they know, kill the stranger was born in them. If any have remembered the blows, the electric shocks, the rolled-up newspapers no one read, the boots and prods, their pain is knotted in now with the stranger, the hated. If there are heresiarchs among the dogs, they are careful about suggesting out loud any extra canine source for these sudden eruptions of lust to kill that take them over. Even the pensive heretics themselves, at any first scent of the stranger. But in private, they point to the remembered image of one human, who has visited only at intervals, but in whose presence they were tranquil and affectionate, from whom came nourishment, kind scratches and strokings, games of fetch the stick. Where is he now? Why is he different for some and not for others? There is a possibility among the dogs, latent so far because it's never been seriously tested, of a crystallizing into sects, each around the image of its trainer. A feasibility study, in fact, is going on even now at staff level in G5 to see whether original trainers might not be located and this crystallizing begun. One sect might try to protect its trainer against attacks from others. Given the right combinations and an acceptable trainer loss figure, it might be cheaper to let the dogs finish themselves off than to send in combat troops. The study has been contracted to, of all people, Mr. Pointsman, who is now restricted to one small office at 12th House, the rest of the space having been taken over by an agency studying options for nationalizing coal and steel, given him more out of sympathy than anything else. Since the castrating of Major Marvey, Pointsman has been officially in disgrace. Clive Mossmoon and Sir Marcus Scammony sit in their club among discarded back copies of British plastics, drinking the night's favorite, Quimporto, a weird pre-war mixture of quinine, beef tea, and port, with a dash of Coca-Cola and a peeled onion. Ostensibly, the meeting is to finalize plans for the post-war polyvinyl chloride raincoat, a source of great corporate fun these days. Imagine the look on some poor bastard's face when the whole sleeve simply falls out of the shoulder. Oh, or how about mixing in something that will actually dissolve in the rain? But Moss Moon really wants to discuss Pointsman. What shall we do with Pointsman? I found the most darling boots in Portobello Road, pipes Sir Marcus, whom it's always hard to get around to talking business.
They'll look stunning on you. Blood-red cordovan and halfway up your thighs, your naked thighs.
We'll give it a go, replies Clive, neutral as can be, though it's a thought old Scorpio's been so damned bitchy lately. I could use a spot of relaxation after trying to explain pointsmen away to the higher levels.
Oh, the dog chap. I say, have you ever thought about a St. Bernard, big shaggy darlings?
On occasion, Clive keeps at it, but mostly I think about pointsmen.
Not your sort, darling, not at all, and he is getting on, poor chap.
Sir Marcus, last resort, usually the willowy knight demands to be called Angelique, and there seems no other way to get his attention. If this show prangs, we're going to see a national crisis. I've got ginger groupers jamming my switchboard and my mailbox day and night.
I'd like to jam your mailbox, Clivey.
And 1922 committee coming in the windows. Bracken and Beaverbrook go on, you know. It isn't as if the election put them out of a job or something.
Dear chap, smiling angelically, there isn't going to be any crisis. Labor wants the American found as much as we do. We sent him out to destroy blacks, and it's obvious now he won't do the job. What harm can he cause roaming around Germany? For all we know, he's taken ship for South America and all those adorable little mustachios. Let it be for a while. We've got the army when the time is right. Slothrop was a good try at a moderate solution, but in the end it's always the army, isn't it?
How can you be so sure the Americans will ever condone that?
A long, disagreeable giggle.
Clive, you're such a little boy. You don't know the Americans. I do. I deal with them. They'll want to see how we do with our lovely black animals. Oh, dear ex-Africa semper aliquid novi, they're so big, so strong. Before they try it on their own, target groups. They may say a good many harsh things if we fail, but there'll be no sanctions.
Are we going to fail?
We're all going to fail, Sir Marcus primping his curls. But the operation won't.
Yes, Clive Mossmoon feels himself rising as from a bog of trivial frustrations, political fears, money problems, delivered onto the sober shore of the operation, where all is firm underfoot, where the self is a petty, indulgent animal that once cried in its mired darkness. But here there is no whining, here, inside the operation. There is no lower self. The issues are too momentous for the lower self to interfere. Even in the chastisement room at Sir Marcus's estate, the Birches, the foreplay is a game about who has the real power, who's had it all along, chained and corseted though he be, outside these shackled walls. The humiliations of pretty Angelique are calibrated against their degree of fantasy. No joy, no real surrender, only the demands of the operation. Each of us has his place, and the tenants come and go, but the places remain. It wasn't always so. In the trenches of the First World War, English men came to love one another decently, without shame or make-believe, under the easy likelihoods of their sudden deaths, and to find in the faces of other young men evidence of otherworldly visits, some poor hope that may have helped redeem even mud, shit, the decaying pieces of human meat. It was the end of the world. It was total revolution, though not quite in the way Walter Rathenau had announced. Every day, thousands of the aristocracy, new and old, still haloed in their ideas of right and wrong, went to the loud guillotine of Flanders, run day in and out, on and on, by no visible hands, certainly not those of the people. An English class was being decimated. The ones who'd volunteered were dying for those who'd known something and hadn't, and despite it all, despite knowing some of them of the betrayal, while Europe died meanly in its own wastes, men loved. But the life cry of that love has long since hissed away into no more than this idle and bitchy faggotry. In this latest war, death was no enemy, but a collaborator. Homosexuality in high places is just a carnal afterthought now, and the real and only fucking is done on paper. 4. The Counterforce. What?
Richard M. Nixon. Betty Davis and Margaret Dumont are in the Curly Cuvier's drawing room of somebody's palatial home. From outside the window at some point comes the sound of a kazoo, playing a tune of astounding tastelessness, probably Who Dat Man, from A Day at the Races, in more ways than one. It is one of Groucho Marx's vulgar friends. The sound is low, buzzing, and guttural. Betty Davis freezes, tosses her head, flicks her cigarette. What, she inquires, is that? Margaret Dumont smiles, throws out her chest, looks down her nose. Well, it sounds, she replies, like a kazoo. For all Slothrop knows, it was a kazoo. By the time he's awake, the racket has faded in the morning. Whatever it was, it woke him up. What it was, or is Pirate Prentice, in a more or less hijacked P-47, en route to Berlin. His orders are terse and clear, like those of the others, agents of the Pope. Pope got religion, go out and find that Minnesinger, he's a good guy after all. Well, it's an older jug, one with a greenhouse canopy. The barred field of sight gives Pirate twinges of memory in his neck muscles. The plane seems permanently out of trim to him, though he still fiddles now and then with different tabs. Right now he's trying the war emergency power to see how it works, even though there seems to be no war, no emergency, keeping an eye on the panel where RPMs, manifold pressure, and cylinder head temperature are all nudging their red lines. He eases it down and flies on, and presently is trying a slow roll over Celle, then a loop over Brunswick, then, what the hell, an Immelmann over Magdeburg. On his back, molars aching in a grin, he starts his roll a hair too slow, just this side of 130, and nearly stalls it, jolts over a set of surprise points, finish it as an ordinary loop or go for the Immelmann, already reaching for ailerons, forget the damn rudder, a spin isn't worth worrying about, but at the last second does give the pedal just a touch anyway, a minor compromise, I'm nearly 40, good God, is it happening to me too, and rolls himself upright again. It had to be the Immelmann. Oh, I'm the eagle of tooting, bombing and shooting, and nobody can bring me down. Old Kaiser Bill, you're over the hill, 'cause I'm coming into your hometown. Tell all the fräuleins and mademoiselles to keep a light in the window for me, 'cause I'm the eagle of tooting, just rooty toot tooting, and flying on to victory. By now, Osby Feel ought to be in Marseille, already trying to contact Blodgett Waxwing. Webley Silvernail is en route to Zurich. Katya will be going to Nordhausen. Katya. No, she hasn't told him everything she's been up to. It's none of his business. However much she told him, there'd always be the bit of mystery to her, because of what he is, because of directions he can't move in. But how is it both of them kept from vanishing from each other into the paper cities and afternoons of this strange peace and the coming austerity? Could it be there's something about ad hoc arrangements, like the present mission, that must bring you in touch with the people you need to be with? That more formal adventures tend, by their nature, to separation, to loneliness? Ah, Prentice. What's this, a runaway prop? No, check the fuel pressure. Here's the gauge needle wobbling, rather low, tanks run dry. Little in-flight annoyance for Pirate here, nothing serious. Out of his earphones now and then, ghost voices will challenge or reprimand him, air traffic people down in their own kingdom, one more overlay on the zone, antennas strung in the wilderness like redoubts, radiating half-spheres of influence, defining invisible corridors in a sky that are real only for them. The thunderbolt is painted Kelly green, hard to miss, Pirate's idea. Gray was for the war. Let them chase. Catch me if you can. Gray was for the war. So, it seems, was Pirate's odd talent for living the fantasies of others. Since V.E. Day, nothing. But it's not the end of his psychic difficulties. He is still being haunted in the same marginal and uncertain way by Katya's ancestor, Franz van der Groff, dodo killer and soldier of fortune. The man never quite arrives, nor quite leaves. Pirate is taking it personally. He is the Dutchman's compatible host, despite himself. What does Franz see in him? Has it to do, of course it does, with the firm? He has warped a skein of his dreams into Pirate's own, heretical dreams, exegeses of windmills that turned in shadow at the edges of dark fields, each arm pointing at a spot on the rim of a giant wheel that turned through the sky, stop and go, always exactly with the spinning cross. Wind was a middle term, a convention to express what really moved the cross. And this applied to all wind, everywhere on earth, shrieking between the confectionery pink and yellow mountains of Mauritius, or stirring the tulips at home, red cups in the rain filling bead by clear bead with water, each wind had its own cross in motion, materially there or implied, each cross a unique mandala bringing opposites together in the spin. And tell me now, Franz, what's this wind I'm in, this 25,000-foot wind? What mill's that grinding there below? What does it grind, Franz? Who tends the stone? Far beneath the belly of the thunderbolt, brushed on the green countryside, past the time-softened outlines of ancient earthworks, villages abandoned during the great dying, fields behind cottages whose dwellers were scythed down without mercy by the northward march of black plague. Behind a scrim, cold as sheets over furniture in a forbidden wing of the house, a soprano voice sings notes that never arrange themselves into a melody, that fall apart in the same way as dead proteins. "It's as clear as the air," rants Gustav, the composer. "If you weren't an old fool, you'd see it. I know, there's an old fool's benevolent association. You all know each other. You vote censures against the most troublesome under-70s, and my name's at the head of the list. Do you think I care? You're all on a different frequency. There's no way you'll get interference from us. We're too far separated. We have our own problems." Cryptozoa of many kinds scurry through crumbs, pubic hairs, wine splashes, tobacco ash and shreds, a litter of dram cocaine vials, each with a red bakelite top bearing the seal of Merck of Darmstadt. The bug's atmosphere ends about an inch from the floor. An ideal humidity, darkness, stability of temperature. Nobody bothers them. There is an unspoken agreement about not stomping on bugs in Zoiler's place. "You're caught in tonality," screams Gustav. "Trapped. Tonality is a game. All of them are. You're too old. You'll never move beyond the game to the row. The row is enlightenment." "The row is a game, too." Zoiler sits grinning with an ivory spoon, shoveling incredible piles of cocaine into his nose, going through his whole repertoire, arms straight out swinging in a giant curve, zoom precisely to the nostril he's aiming at, then flicking in the lot from 2 feet away without losing a crystal. Then a whole bunch gets tossed up in the air like a piece of popcorn, and nose-gobbled ngok on target, inside where it's smooth as a Joe block. Not a psyllium in sight there since the Liebknecht funeral, if not before. Hand-to-hand shifts of spoon 2 or 3 times, faster than ivory ever moved in air, rails disappearing in a wink without benefit of a tube to guide them. "Sound is a game if you're capable of moving that far, you adenoidal closet visionary. That's why I listen to Spohr, Rossini, Spontini. I'm choosing my game, one full of light and kindness. You're stuck with that stratosphere stuff and rationalize its dullness away by calling it enlightenment. You don't what enlightenment is, girl. You're blinder than I am." Slothrop moseys down the trail to a mountain stream where he's left his harp to soak all night, wedged between a couple of rocks in a quiet pool. "Your light and kindness are the jigging of the doomed," says Gustav. "You can smell mortality in every one of those bouncy little tunes." Surly, he decapitates a vial of cocaine with his teeth and spits the red debris in among the shimmering bugs. Through the flowing water, the holes of the old honer Slothrop found are warped one by one, squares being bent like notes, a visual blues being played by the clear stream. There are harpmen and dulcimer players in all the rivers, wherever water moves, like that Rilke prophesied. "And though earthliness forget you, to the stilled earth say, I flow. To the rushing water speak, I am." It is still possible, even this far out of it, to find and make audible the spirits of lost harpmen. Whacking the water out of his harmonica, reeds singing against his leg, picking up the single blues at bar one of this morning's segment, Slothrop just sucking on his harp is closer to being a spiritual medium than he's been yet, and he doesn't even know it. The harp didn't show up right away. His first days in these mountains, he came across a set of bagpipes, left behind in April by some Highland unit. Slothrop has a knack for doping things out. The imperial instrument was a cinch. In a week he mastered that dreamy tune Dick Powell sang in the movies, In the Shadows Let Me Come and Sing to You, and spent most of his time playing that wang-de-diddle-dee-dee, wang-de-dum-dee-doo, over and over on the bagpipes. By and by he began to notice that offerings of food were being left near the lean-to he'd put up, mangelwurzels, a basket of cherries, even fresh fish. He never saw who was leaving them. Either he was supposed to be a bagpiper's ghost or just purely sound itself, and he knew enough about solitudes and night voices to figure what was going on. He quit playing the bagpipes, and next day he found the harp. It happens to be the same one he lost in 1938 or 9 down the toilet at the Roseland Ballroom, but that's too long ago for him to remember. He's kept alone. If others have seen him or his fire, they haven't tried to approach. He's letting hair and beard grow, wearing a dungaree shirt and trousers Bodine liberated for him from the laundry of the Johnny Badass. But he likes to spend whole days naked, ants crawling up his legs, butterflies lighting on his shoulders, watching the life on the mountain, getting to know shrikes and capercaillie, badgers and marmots. Any number of directions he ought to be moving in, but he'd rather stay right here for now. Every place he's been, Cuxhaven, Berlin, Nice, Zurich, must be watched now. He could still make a try at finding Springer or Blotted Waxwing. Why does he have this obsession with getting papers? What the fuck are papers, anyhow? He could try one of the Baltic ports, wait around for Frau Knob to put in, and get over to that Denmark or that Sweden. DPs, offices burned, records lost forever. Papers might not mean so much in Europe. Wait a minute. So much as where, Slothrop, huh? America? Shit, come on. Yep, still thinking there's a way to get back. He's been changing, sure, changing, plucking all the albatross of self now and then, idly, half-conscious as picking his nose, but the one ghost feather his fingers always brush by is America. Poor asshole, he can't let her go. She's whispered, love me, too often to him in his sleep, vamped insatiably his waking attention with come-hitherings, incredible promises. One day, he can see a day, he might be able finally to say, sorry. Sure, and leave her, but not just yet. One more try, one more chant, one more deal, one more transfer to a hopeful line. Maybe it's just pride. What if there's no place for him in her stable anymore? If she has turned him out, she'll never explain. Her stallions have no rights. She is immune to their small, stupid questions. She is exactly the Amazon bitch your fantasies have called her to be. Then there's Yamph, the coupling of Yamph and I in the primal dream. Who can he go to with it? It will not bear that much looking into, will it? If he gets too close, there will be revenge. They might warn him first. They might not. Omens grow clearer, more specific. He watches flights of birds and patterns in the ashes of his fire. He reads the guts of trout he's caught and cleaned, scraps of lost paper, graffiti on the broken walls where facing has been shot away to reveal the brick underneath, broken in specific shapes that may also be red. One night, on the wall of a public shithouse, stinking and ripe with typhoid, he finds among initials, dates, hasty pictures of penises and mouths open to receive them, werewolf stencils of the dark man with the high shoulders and the Hamburg hat, an official slogan, Willst du V2, dann arbeite. If you want the V2, then work. Good evening, Tyrone Slothrop. No, no, wait, it's okay, over on the other wall, they've also painted, Willst du V4, dann arbeite. Lucky. The brimming voices recede, the joke clarifies. He is only back with Goebbels and the man's inability to let a good thing be. But it had taken an effort to walk around and look at that other wall. Anything could have been back there. It was dusk. Cloud fields, power lines, ditches, and distant windbreaks went for miles. He felt brave and in control, but then another message caught his eye. Rocket Man was here. His first thought was that he'd written it himself and forgot. Odd that that should have been his first thought, but it was. Might be he was starting to implicate himself, some yesterday version of himself, in the combination against who he was right then. In its sluggish coma, the albatross stirred. Past Slothrops, say, averaging one a day, 10,000 of them, some more powerful than others, had been going over every sundown to the furious host. They were the fifth columnists. Well inside his head, waiting the moment to deliver him to the four other divisions outside, closing in. So, next to the other graffiti, with a piece of rock, he scratches this sign. Narrator's note. Here appears two concentric circles with four projecting fins. End of narrator's note. Slothrop besieged. Only after he'd left it half a dozen more places did it dawn on him that what he was really drawing was the A4 rocket seen from below, by which time he had become tuned to other fourfold expressions, variations on Franz van der Groff's cosmic windmill, swastikas, gymnastic symbols FFFF in a circle symmetrically upside down and backward, Frisch, fromm, fröhlich, frei over neat doorways and quiet streets and crossroads where you can sit and listen in to traffic from the other side, hearing about the future. No serial time over there. Events are all there in the same eternal moment, and so certain messages don't always make sense back here. They lack historical structure. They sound fanciful or insane. The sand-colored church tops rear up on Slothrop's horizons, apses out to four sides like rocket fins guiding the streamlined spires. Chiseled in the sandstone he finds waiting the mark of consecration, a cross in a circle. At last, lying one afternoon spread-eagled at his ease in the sun, at the edge of one of the ancient plague towns, he becomes a cross himself, a crossroads, a living intersection where the judges have come to set up a gibbet for a common criminal who is to be hanged at noon. Black hounds and fanged little hunters, slick as weasels, dogs whose breeds have been lost for 700 years, chase a female in heat as the spectators gather. It's the fourth hanging this spring, and not much spectacle here except that this one, dreaming at the last instant of who can say what lifted smock, what fat-haunched gnädige Frau Death may have come sashaying in as gets an erection, a tremendous dark purple swelling, and just as his neck breaks, he actually comes in his ragged loin-wrapping, creamy as the skin of a saint under the purple cloak of Lent. And one drop of sperm succeeds in rolling, dripping hair to hair down the dead leg all the way down, off the edge of the crusted bare foot, drips to earth at the exact center of the crossroad where, in the workings of the night, it changes into a mandrake root. Next Friday at dawn, the magician, his own moving Heiligenschein rippling infrared to ultraviolet in spectral rings around his shadow over the dewy grass, comes with his dog, a coal-black dog who hasn't been fed for a few days. The magician digs carefully all around the precious root till it's held only by the finest root hairs, ties it to the tail of his black dog, stops his own ears with wax, then comes out with a piece of bread to lure the unfed dog. Ralph! Dog lunges for bread, root is torn up, and lets loose its piercing and fatal scream. The dog drops dead before he's halfway to breakfast. His holy light freezes and fades in the million dewdrops. Magician takes the root tenderly home, dresses it in a little white outfit, and leaves money with it overnight. In the morning, the cash has multiplied tenfold. A delegate from the Committee on Idiopathic Archetypes comes to visit. Inflation? The magician tries to cover up with some flowing hand moves. Capital? Never heard of that. No, no, replies the visitor. Not at the moment. We're trying to think ahead. We'd like very much to hear about the basic structure of this. How bad was the scream, for instance? Had me ears plugged up, couldn't hear it. The delegate flashes a fraternal business smile. Can't say as I blame you. Crosses, swastikas, zone mandalas, how can they not speak to Slothrop? He's sat in Zoiler Boomer's kitchen, the air streaming with kief moirés, reading soup recipes and finding in every bone and cabbage leaf paraphrases of himself. News flashes, names of wheel horses that will pay him off for a certain getaway. He used to pick and shovel at the spring roads of Berkshire. April afternoons he's lost Chapter 81 work, they called it. Following the scraper that clears the winter's crystal attack from within, its white necropolizing. Picking up rusted beer cans, rubbers yellow with preterite seed. Kleenex wadded to brain shapes hiding preterite snot, preterite tears, newspapers, broken glass, pieces of automobile, days when in superstition and fright he could make it all fit, seeing clearly in each an entry in a record, a history, his own, his winters, his country's, instructing him, dunce and drifter, in ways deeper than he can explain, have been faces of children out the train windows, two bars of dance music somewhere in some other street at night, needles and branches of a pine tree shaken clear and luminous against night clouds, one circuit diagram out of hundreds in a smudged, yellowing sheaf, laughter out of a cornfield in the early morning as he was walking to school, the idling of a motorcycle at one dusk-heavy hour of the summer. And now, in the zone, later in the day he became a crossroad. After a heavy rain, he doesn't recall, Slothrop sees a very thick rainbow here, a stout rainbow cock, driven down out of pubic clouds into earth, green, wet, valleyed earth, and his chest fills, and he stands crying, not a thing in his head, just feeling natural. Doubled clutchingly, heel and toe, away goes Roger Mexico. Down the summer autobahn, expansion joints booming rhythmic under his wheels, he highballs a pre-Hitler Horch 870B through the burnt purple rolling of the Lüneburg heath. Over the windscreen, mild winds blow down on him, smelling of junipers. Heidschnucken sheep out there rest as still as fallen clouds. The bogs and broom go speeding by. Overhead the sky is busy, streaming, a living plasma. The Horch, army green with one discreet daffodil painted halfway up its bonnet, was lurking inside a lorry at the Elpward edge of the brigade pool at Hamburg, shadowed except for its headlamps, stalked eyes of a friendly alien smiling at Roger. Welcome there, Earthman. Once underway, he discovered the floor strewn with rolling unlabeled glass jars of what seems to be baby food. Weird, unhealthy colored stuff no human baby could possibly eat and survive. Green marbled with pink, vomit beige with magenta inclusions, all impossible to identify, each cap adorned with a smiling, fat, cherubic baby, seething under the bright glass with horrible botulism toxins and ptomaines. Now and then a new jar will be produced, spontaneously under the seat and roll out, against all laws of acceleration among the pedals for his feet to get confused by. He knows he ought to look back underneath there to find out what's going on, but can't quite bring himself to. Bottles roll clanking on the floor under the bonnet. A hung-up tappet or two chatters its story of discomfort. Wild mustard whips past down the center of the autobahn, perfectly two-toned, just yellow and green, a fateful river seen only by the two kinds of rippling light. Roger sings to a girl in Cuxhaven who still carries Jessica's name. I dream that I have found us both again, with spring so many strangers' lives away, and we, so free, out walking by the sea, with someone else's paper words to say. They took us at the gates of green return, too lost by then to stop, and ask them why. Do children meet again? Does any trace remain along the superhighways of July? Driving now suddenly into such a bright gold bearding of slope and field that he nearly forgets to steer around the banked curve. A week before she left, she came out to the white visitation for the last time. Except for the negligible rump of Pisces, the place was a loony bin again. The barrage balloon cables lay rusting across the sodden meadows, going to flakes, to ions and earth. Tendons that sang in the violent nights, among the sirens wailing in thirds smooth as distant wind, among the drumbeats of bombs now lying slack, old, in hard twists of metal ash. Forget-me-nots boil everywhere underfoot, and ants crowd, bustling with a sense of kingdom. Commas, brimstones, painted ladies coast on the thermoclines along the cliffs. Jessica has cut fringes since Roger saw her last and is going through the usual anxiety. It looks utterly horrible. You don't have to say it. It's utterly swoony, says Roger. I love it. You're making fun. Yes, why are we talking about haircuts, for God's sake? While somewhere out beyond the channel, a barrier difficult as the wall of death to a novice medium, Lieutenant Slothrop, corrupted, given up on, creeps over the face of the zone. Roger doesn't want to give him up. Roger wants to do what's right. I just can't leave the poor twit out there, can I? They're trying to destroy him. But, Roger, she'd smile, it's spring, we're at peace. No, we're not. It's another bit of propaganda. Something the PWE planted. Now, gentlemen, as you've seen from the studies, our optimum time is 8 May, just before the traditional Whitsun exodus. Schools letting out, weather projections for an excellent growing season, coal requirements beginning their seasonal decline, giving us a few months' grace to get our Ruhr interests back on their feet. No, he sees only the same flows of power, the same impoverishments he's been thrashing around in since 39. His girl is about to be taken away to Germany, when she ought to be demobbed like everyone else. No channel upward that will show either of them any hope of escape. There's something still on. Don't call it a war if it makes you nervous. Maybe the death rate's gone down a point or two. Beer in cans is back at last, and there were a lot of people in Trafalgar Square one night not so long ago. But their enterprise goes on. The sad fact, lacerating his heart, laying open his emptiness, is that Jessica believes them. The war was the condition she needed for being with Roger. Peace allows her to leave him. His resources, next to theirs, are too meager. He has no words, no technically splendid embrace, no screaming fit that can ever hold her. Old Beaver, not surprisingly, will be doing air defense liaison over there, so they'll be together in Romantic Cuxhaven. Ta-ta, Mad Roger. It's been grand. A wartime fling. When we came, it was utterly incendiary. Your arms open wide as a fortress's wings. We had our military secrets. We fooled the fat old colonels right and left, but stand down, time must come to all. Yikes, I must run, sweet Roger. Really, it's been dreamy. He would fall at her knees, smelling of glycerin and rose water. He would lick sand and salt from her ATS brogans, offer her his freedom, his next 50 years' pay from a good steady job, his poor throbbing brain. But it's too late. We're at peace. The paranoia, the danger, the tuneless whistling of busy death next door are all put to sleep. Back in the war, back with her Roger Mexico years. The day the rockets stopped falling, it began to end for Roger and Jessica. As it grew clear, day after safe day, that no more would fall ever again, the new world crept into and over her like spring. Not so much the changes she felt in air and light, in the crowds at Woolworth's, as a bad cinema spring full of paper leaves and cotton wool blossoms and phony lighting. No, never again will she stand at their kitchen sink, with a china cup squeaking in her fingers, its small, crying child sound defenseless, meekly resonating, blown out of attention as the rocket fell, smashing to a clatter of points white and blue across the floor. Those death rockets now are in the past. This time, she'll be on the firing end, she and Jeremy. Isn't that how it was always meant to be? Firing them out to sea. No death, only the spectacle. Fire and roar. The excitement without the killing. Isn't that what she prayed for? Back in the fading house, derequisitioned now, occupied again by human extensions of ball fringe, dog pictures, Victorian chairs, secret piles of news of the world in the upstairs closet. She's meant to go. The orders come from higher than she can reach. Her future is with the world's own, and Roger's only with this strange version of the war he still carries with him. He can't move, poor dear, it won't let him go. Still passive as he'd been under the rockets. Roger the victim, Jeremy the firer. "The war's my mother," he said the first day, and Jessica has wondered what ladies in black appeared in his dreams, what ash-white smiles, what shears to come snapping through the room, through their winter. So much of him she never got to know. So much unfit for peace. Already she's beginning to think of their time as a chain of explosions. Craziness ganged to the rhythms of the war. Now he wants to go rescue Slothrop, another rocket creature, a vampire whose sex life actually fed on the terror of that rocket blitz. Ugh, creepy, creepy. They ought to lock him up, not set him free. Roger must care more about Slothrop than about her. They're two of a kind, aren't they? Well, she hopes they'll be happy together. They can sit and drink beer, tell rocket stories, scribble equations for each other. How jolly! At least, she won't be leaving him in a vacuum. He won't be lonely. He'll have something to occupy the time. She has wandered away from him down the beach. The sun is so bright today that the shadows by her Achilles tendon are drawn sharp and black as seams up the heel of a silk stocking. Her head is always as bent forward, away. The bare nape he's never stopped loving, will never see again, unprotected as her beauty, her innocence of how forever in peril it moves through the world. She may know a little, may think of herself, face and body, as pretty, but he could never tell her all the rest. How many other living things, birds, nights smelling of grass and rain, sunlit moments of simple peace, also gather in what she is to him, was. He is losing more than single Jessica. He's losing a full range of life, of being for the first time at ease in the creation. Going back to winter now.